It's Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Welcome to an hour of Broadway. Coming up, the Theater Guild on the Air's first broadcast with an adaptation of a play that opened in 1928 and probably the only one that has the distinction of predicting the atomic bomb. Burgess Meredith, Cecil Humphreys, Everett Sloan, and more star in Wings Over Europe, which first opened at the Martin Beck Theater in December of 1928 and ran for over 90 performances. This radio broadcast from September 9th, 1945 on ABC.
The United States Steel Corporation, 500,000 employees and stockholders, presents the first performance of the Theater Guild on the Air. Tonight is Wings Over Europe, starring Burgess Meredith, with Cecil Humphreys, Henry Daniell, and Everett Sloan. Here in the studio and in Hollywood to welcome the Theater Guild on its newest opening night are Annabella, star of stage and screen, Oscar Hammerstein and Richard Rodgers, creators of Oklahoma and Carousel, the Theater Guild's two great musical hits. Edward G. Robinson, William Bendix, Reuben Manmullian, also with us tonight are Teresa Helburn and Lawrence Langner, co-directors of the Theater Guild. And here is Mr. Langner, who will tell you something about the Theater Guild.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to the opening night of the Theater Guild on the Air. In the theater, opening nights are very exciting affairs. You sit expectantly in your seat. The lights go down, and there's a magical glow on the curtain. To me, one of the most beautiful things in life is that moment of expectancy. The curtain rises. We hope for a great experience. Too often it's denied us, but every once in a while a fine play is revealed, sometimes a masterpiece, and that is the excitement of the theater. Thanks to our sponsor, we hope to bring you some of this excitement on our program for the next 39 weeks. About this same time after the end of World War Number One, a small group of young people who loved the theater were meeting at my apartment to form the Theater Guild. We took ourselves very seriously, which was just as well, because no one else did. We had very little financial capital. As a matter of fact, just $500. But our real capital was our love of the good things of the theater, and our faith that the American public, given the opportunity, would share this love with us. Our faith was more than justified. We've since produced over 150 plays in the theater, some gay, some serious, some both gay and serious, and now we are bringing them to you over the air. We shall give you the cream of the crop, and where possible, with the actors and actresses who created the parts in the theater. We shall bring you the best plays of the best authors: Eugene O'Neill, S.N. Behrman, Maxwell Anderson, Philip Barry, Ference Molnar, and last but not least, George Bernard Shaw. Speaking of Mr. Shaw, I recently received a cablegram from him reading, "The answer is definitely no." Since I hadn't asked him for anything, I couldn't quite get his meaning, except as a general statement of his attitude towards life. However, I'm happy to announce that for the first time in the history of radio, Mr. Shaw has just given the Theater Guild permission to take our pick of all his plays over the air. But he adds, uncut and uncooked. And you all know what that means. And now, before our play begins, a word from Mr. Brokenshire.
Tonight marks the first time that the United States Steel Corporation has sponsored a nationwide radio program. The men and women of U.S. Steel feel privileged that they are able to bring you the leading plays and players of one of the world's great theatrical organizations. In presenting the Theater Guild on the Air to you, United States Steel hopes to widen its circle of friends and to acquaint you with some of the interesting facts about the basic industry of which it is an important part. We hope that through these programs, we can help you to become better acquainted with the United States Steel Corporation and its subsidiary companies, its workers and its management, its policies and its operations. And now, Here is Lawrence Langner again to tell you about tonight's play.
Ladies and gentlemen, Wings Over Europe has been chosen for our opening program because way back in 1927, it prophesied the atomic bomb and all the problems that humanity would face by its discovery. 17 years ago, it was considered pure fantasy, but we felt there was enough reality in it to make us stop and wonder whether science wasn't moving forward too rapidly for men to keep up with it. Today, we're still wondering. For its first performance on the air, the Theatre Guild presents Maurice Barnes and Robert Nichols, Wings Over Europe, starring Burgess Meredith, and featuring Cecil Humphreys, Henry Daniel, and Everett Sloan.
It is the year 1927. Our scene is in London at number 10 Downing Street, the famous meeting place of the British Cabinet and the home of the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister is waiting for his nephew, the brilliant young scientist, Francis Lightfoot. But in the meantime, he's conferring with two prominent doctors.
Well, Dr. Barclay, what's the verdict?
Sir Henry and I are in complete agreement. Your nephew is perfectly normal.
Certain?
Absolutely.
Well. The young man is what is known as highly strung, but not more so than any sensitive man of his attainments.
Mr. Prime Minister, your nephew is a scientific genius, otherwise normal.
Yes, of course.
You seem almost disappointed, sir.
Disappointed? No, not at all. There's that barrel organ again. I just hope to be absolutely certain. No doubt whatever, sir.
The minstrel boy.
Pretty, isn't it?
Did he tell you anything about himself? Only that he was 25 years old, was raised in Canada, and spent some time in the United States. By the way, I've heard from other sources that your nephew is to receive the Nobel Prize this year.
Is that so? An actress and an interest in racehorses at the most upset.
Mr. Francis Lightfoot.
Good morning, Francis. Simpson, chase that barrel organ away, will you?
Yes, sir. Morning, Uncle. Ah, gentlemen. Still here?
Just leaving, Mr. Lightfoot. Goodbye.
Goodbye, my boy. Our little talk was most illuminating. Most illuminating.
And I'm not insane.
My dear boy, it never even occurred to us.
Well, that's all right. Goodbye, gentlemen. Well, Uncle, just about complete. You'll have to accept everything now.
I never doubted your sanity,
sir. No, but you wondered if I might have been...
Overworking, yes. In my position as head of the cabinet, in view of this, your incredible discovery...
Well, I forgive you. I could forgive anybody this morning. Think. Today, for the first time in history, man is free.
Well, everything's ready. When the cabinet of members arrive, you'll be introduced. Then you'll sit yourself right here behind me and prepare for battle.
For battle? None. Uncle, if I were to say to you, I'm a terrible angel who offers you a choice on which you must decide in the next 5 minutes, and the choice is, will you live or will you die? I tell you, it's as simple as that.
Is it?
Yes.
Francis, I only hope you're right, that my colleagues will understand you. Well, there's one who will, anyhow. That's Austin Arthur, the Foreign Secretary. Go after him, my boy. Play to Arthur.
Play to him?
By the way, a cabinet meeting, you know. Don't you think a necktie?
I hate neckties.
Look at my colleagues, the impression.
If my statement that I've smashed the atom and learned to harness it to man's will can't produce an impression, a necktie certainly won't.
Oh, you can't tell. Anyhow, in honor of so great an occasion, you know, the freeing of mankind.
All right, Uncle. I'll put on a green one.
Green?
To symbolize a new birth. The birthday of humanity.
Gentlemen, we meet on a momentous occasion.
Well, what are we going to do?
Declare war?
You know me well enough, gentlemen, to be sure that I do not summon you in this peremptory manner without due cause. About Mr. Lightfoot, I will content myself with two observations. One, that Professor Einstein regards him as the greatest scientific genius of the age. Two, that Mr. Lightfoot will receive this year at the unprecedented age of 25 the Nobel Prize. Did you know that, Francis?
No, I didn't, Uncle. Go on.
Yes. Gentlemen, before introducing him, I should like to mention that Mr. Lightfoot proposes to make a statement only. Action he leaves to us. Now then, gentlemen, I present you to my nephew, Sir Francis Lightfoot. I will run rapidly over the names round this table. Sir Romilly Blunt, First Lord of the Admiralty.
How do you do, sir?
Delighted, young man, delighted.
Sir Richard Stapp, Secretary of State for War.
How do you do, sir?
How are you, my boy?
Lord Dedham, the Lord Chancellor.
How do you do, sir?
Very well, thank you.
Mr. Grindal, Chancellor of the Exchequer.
How do you do, sir?
How do you do?
And last, but far from least, Mr. Austin Arthur, Secretary for Foreign Affairs.
A great privilege to make your acquaintance, young man. Your work is not unknown to me, and I'm honored.
Thank you, sir.
And now, Francis, you may go ahead.
Thank you. Prime Minister and gentlemen.
Prime Minister, before Mr. Lightfoot begins, I would like to put a question. Why does he not make his statement to the scientific society?
Because it is so great a secret that may be disclosed to no less exalted a company than the Special Cabinet Council of the British Empire.
Thank you. I beg your pardon, Mr. Lightfoot. Proceed.
Yes. Prime Minister and gentlemen, in science there are two methods.
One moment. Mr. Lightfoot's father was, I trust, of British nationality.
His father and his father's father's for 11 centuries. Anything else? No, go on, my boy.
Thank you. Gentlemen, my discovery is the product of a 5-year-long shortcut in investigation I'm making.
Here, Mr. Lightfoot, or in a foreign country?
Mr. Lightfoot's laboratory is in the west of England. Go on, Francis.
Gentlemen, just as life manifests itself constantly in changing structures known as bodies, so electricity manifests itself in the perpetual dance of energies known as negative electrons around a positively charged nucleus. Such groups are...
Prime Minister, may I? Thank you. Now, look here, young man. We're politicians, heaven help us, not professors. Couldn't you explain it to the others after I've gone? I've got a deputation waiting.
Sir, save you all.
Give us the results, my boy. We believe you.
Very well. Gentlemen, I can control the energy in the atmosphere.
Sorry. What's that? I was blowing my nose.
I said I can control the energy in the atom.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
Tell them, Francis, what you told me last night.
Well, it means that the present, all this that you're accustomed to call civilization, is relegated at last to its proper place as the confused remembrance of an evil dream of no more account than a child's nightmare. Yesterday, man was a slave. Today, he is free. Matter obeys him.
Mr. Lightfoot, I've risen to my present position as Lord Chancellor by my obstinate preference for facts as opposed to fancy conversation.
Who the devil do you think you're talking to?
Chance, my dear young man, Lord Dedham.
I'm giving you facts. You refuse to listen. You're all too busy with blowing your noses and deputations. Perhaps you'll listen to this. So far as matter is concerned, what I will to be will be, and what I will not to be will not be. That's fact enough.
Mr. Lightfoot, I...
Lord Dedham, may I remind you that Mr. Lightfoot is here of his own free will.
Prime Minister.
Yes, Arthur.
Perhaps I can offer an illustration. Lord Dedham, you see this table we're sitting at?
Of course I see it.
Very well, then. If Mr. Lightfoot was so vulgar as to wish to turn it into gold, he could do so.
What's that?
If he wished to turn it into bread, he could do that too. And if he wished to abolish it, he could abolish it. Simply by a rearrangement or explosion of the atom. Isn't that it?
Yes. Put it a bit crudely, but that's what it means. Gentlemen, the history of man up to now has been one long, horrible narrative of his slavery to matter. Today, I put into your hands the power over matter. Power of a god to slay or to make alive. It means food, shelter, abundance for everyone, but that's just incidental. Beyond that food and shelter rises the new world, the golden age. Don't you see, gentlemen? Man is free. Now he can live as the sages of all countries have always dreamed that he might. Not a feebly struggling parasite, not a thing oppressed by needs and fears with no security or no leisure, but a man, a titan, a Prometheus triumphant. all his days and nights, one long hymn of praise to beauty and truth. Well, that's what it means, gentlemen. That's what my discovery means. Now, you're the first to know. I'm going to leave you to organize things at your job, the new organization. Goodbye, I'll come back in a month.
One moment, indeed. But tell me, young man, exactly what do you mean by organized things?
Well, I don't know.
You don't know?
Well, gentlemen, as cabinet ministers, it's your business to formulate plans for any emergency. What would happen if war were declared? Would you come to me for advice on military strategy? But this is a greater emergency. Peace is declared. Eternal peace. And you gentlemen are the responsible parties. You're the government. All I ask of you is to govern.
Tell me, Mr. Lightfoot, how will this discovery of yours affect my department?
I refer, of course, to the law.
The law, at least your system of it, will cease to exist.
What's that?
It's quite simple. Your system of law relies at bottom on force. That's what a policeman represents. In the new world, all displays of force are equally criminal, since one man could quite easily release enough force to destroy civilization. Put it this way. Neither party is equally able to destroy the other. What do we have? Stalemate. And then arbitration. Otherwise, it means total destruction. Lord Dedham, by the use of my formula, one man, no, one weak, crippled child can defy all the policemen in London.
Wow.
He touches a spring. The atoms about the mechanism begin to redistribute themselves at an undreamt of speed, at such speed that not only he, his house, his, the street, the London itself disappears.
But surely you don't mean
Sir Romilly, one moment, please. Tell me, Mr. Lightfoot, would the ordinary man be allowed that knowledge?
How can you prevent it? The same energy released at a lower speed will shortly be driving at a nominal cost his automobile and every engine in the world.
What's that? Well, what's going to happen to the coal mines I own?
Coal? Coal would be as obsolete as a dinosaur.
Well, what about my oil stocks, eh? What about oil?
Dead as a dodo. Any more questions, Sir Romilly?
Yes. What about the Navy?
There won't be any.
Won't be? Britain without a Navy? What are you talking
about? Sir Romilly, I assure you one atomic bomb dropped on any naval base will transform every ship within 100 miles into granulated dust. Same holds true for the Army.
Mr. Lightfoot, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, I should like to ask a question. Was the Foreign Secretary having a go at me? Can you turn that table into gold? Solid gold?
22 carats.
Good Lord.
What's the matter?
Do you realize what this means? It means that gold is no longer the... Well, we'll have to go off the gold standard.
Perhaps.
The British pound, based on silver, how degrading.
I can turn the table into silver, too.
Good Lord.
What about labor?
Mr. Foreign Secretary, some of it will cease to exist as labor, I mean. Miners, for instance. The important thing is that every man, woman, and child will have plenty of leisure to enjoy life. Look here, Mr. Arthur. You, of all the cabinet ministers, yes, even including my uncle, are the most intelligent, the one most capable of understanding that the old order is no more. It's obsolete, dead as a...
Dodo, I believe you.
Yes. And if these idiotic politicians...
Just a moment, gentlemen. Have patience with me, Francis. What's to become of the empire?
You speak of the empire. I speak of all mankind.
Yes, of course you do, my boy. We realize, of course, that contingent upon our acceptance, you're in a position to take this discovery wherever you wish, to Germany or Russia. Is that right?
Well, the control of the atom is for the benefit of all mankind. Of course, someone will have to start things off.
Ah, yes, of course. Francis, my boy, the hope for the future you hold out to us is magnificent, sublime. We of the Cabinet have done our duty in the past and shall rise to it now. Speaking for us all, I say we thank you from the bottom of our hearts, not only in our names, but in the name of humanity.
Thank you, sir. And I ask you to take nothing on trust. I will send you details of time and place for tests that I've arranged. Through just simple demonstrations, they will prove, without revealing my method, that I can do what I say I can. Goodbye, gentlemen. I'll see you at the proving ground. Meanwhile, you arrange your program. Have your plans ready for the new world. Gentlemen, here we are.
Desolate country you picked for your demonstration, my boy.
I had to, sir. You won't find a house within 20 miles. Lord Dedham.
Yes, my boy.
I trust your men are blocking off all roads into this area.
They are, though I must say I don't know why.
You will? Gentlemen, are there any questions before we begin?
Yes, old boy. Shall I have a chair?
I'm sorry, Sir Romilly. There are none.
Oh, I'd like to have a chair, you know. Always enjoy a show better sitting down.
I'd like to remind you, sir, that we're not at Covent Garden.
Easy, sir.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Yes, Mr. Staff.
I don't suppose there's much chance of an accident.
Not very likely, sir.
What's the matter, Staff? Got the wind up?
Oh, not me. I'm just trying to make it easy for Grindle here. He seems a bit worried.
Well, not worried exactly, but after all, I do have six children.
Well, they're not here, old boy. Nothing can happen to them. Well, what are we waiting for? Let the performance begin. Curtain.
Very well, gentlemen. The overture is over. The curtain is up. Sir Romilly, you seem the most skeptical of all those present. Suppose we begin with you.
Oh, certainly, my boy. What do I do? Sing the opening aria?
No, I ask you to place your latch key in this apparatus.
Just drop it in?
Yes, please, yes. Thank you. Now, gentlemen, step back a pace or two, thank you. And I'll close the lid and press the control. Kindly lift the lid.
Certainly.
What do you see?
Well, nothing, not a thing. Only my latch key, the same as before.
Pick it up and tell me. Is it the same as before? It
looks the same and feels the... I say, the color's changed.
Look at it
bit.
Closely, Sir Romilly.
I am, and there's something funny. I say, did you... Why, it's gold.
Gold?
No need to examine it, gentlemen. I assure you, it is pure gold. Mr. Lightfoot has merely rearranged the atoms, as I told you he could. It's the greatest scientific miracle in the history of the world.
Thank you, Mr. Robert. Gentlemen, we come to the last demonstration.
Francis, my boy, we've seen your examples of transmutation. We've seen your atoms smashed and converted into electrical energy and driving a motor car.
Yes, enough is enough.
No, I have to bring down the curtain, Sir Romilly. On the climax, of course. Now, will everyone be so good as to put on these sunglasses? Kindly place this cotton in your ears. Thank you. I will now ask you to turn your gaze to that mountain about 8 miles distant.
What now?
You're about to witness the greatest explosion since the beginning of the world.
Explosion? Where's your control? I don't see any wires. Or does one of your assistants handle it?
My secret, Mr. Stapp. Now then, gentlemen, have your glasses on, cotton adjusted. Fine. Keep your eyes on that mountain, please, while I call off. 5 seconds. 5 seconds. 4 seconds. 3 seconds. 2 seconds. 1 second. Gentlemen, just seen the top of that mountain lifted off like the cover from a glass jar. In addition, my calculation is that an area of 4 square miles immediately surrounding it is entirely devastated.
probably not one trace of animal life remaining. And the explosive charge, gentlemen, was not 10,000 tons of TNT, but one ordinary lump of sugar. Gentlemen, one single solitary lump of sugar in which the atoms have been redistributed.
The British cabinet has seen the young scientist, Francis Lightfoot, turn brass into gold, shatter a mountain with atomic power. Now the ministers have reassembled at number 10 Downing Street.
Close the door, Grendel, please.
Thank you.
Well, gentlemen,
I can't get that latchkey out of my head. It is solid gold. I had it examined last week.
Gentlemen, I remind you my nephew is waiting outside for our decision.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Arthur.
I believe I speak for all of us when I say that 2 weeks ago, on a desolate field right here in England, we experienced the most stupendous and terrifying adventure of our lives. Since then, we've met and discussed this matter many times. The question that still confronts us is, what to do about it? Do we dare trust this secret to the world? Is the world prepared for it? On our decision depends the happiness and safety, the very existence of untold generations who come after. Will we, through this decision, plunge the world into chaos? Or, and this is possible, my friend, bring it forward 10,000 years, overcoming untold agony in the process? Do we advance toward the shining hour, the gates of heaven? Or do we fall backwards into the depths? Let each man look into his heart and judge by what he finds there.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Steph.
My answer is no. Anything else would be an invitation to oblivion. The Foreign Secretary asked us to look into our hearts. I say no. Let our heads do the thinking for us. He speaks of untold agonies to be spared future generations. I say, what of the untold agonies of those generations of the past? The agonies out of which came the orderly processes of the world. Shall we, with one wave of the finger, betray those who came before, who suffered and died, that our world might be as it is today? I say no.
Here.
Gentlemen, it would seem that my remarks have been misunderstood. If I presented the affirmative side of the issue, that does not mean I favor it. Not at all. My sentiments are heartily in accord with your own. Prime Minister, I move we decline Mr. Lightfoot's generous offer with thanks.
Dear gentlemen, and now...
One moment. As I see it, the first move is to persuade him to abandon his discovery. Destroy it. What if he won't?
He will. My nephew is a reasonable
young... if he won't?
Why, then, of course, in order to prevent his taking his discovery to a foreign country,
say it, Prime Minister. Your nephew will be segregated.
Yes.
There's one thing we haven't considered. For how long? How long does he stay in prison? For life?
Certainly. Anything less is nothing at all. Anything less is dangerous. He's got to be shut up tight, and shut up for keeps.
No. He must be made to disappear.
Do I take your meaning, Mr. Stamp?
You do, Lord Dedham.
I move we bring the boy in and put it to him.
Thank you, Austin. All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Arthur and Mr. Grendel will kindly escort Mr. Lightfoot into the council chamber. Sit down, Francis.
No, I'd rather stand, thanks. Gentlemen, the month is up. What's your program?
Ah, precisely. The program. Prime Minister.
Francis, after witnessing your stupendous achievement, this committee has come to a decision. We most earnestly and solemnly request and entreat you to communicate this overwhelming discovery to no other human being and to destroy its secret.
What? Destroy?
Yes.
Is it a joke?
No.
You want me? Oh, never.
Never while there are stars in heaven nor a man on earth.
Has it struck you, Francis, that if you don't, there may soon be no man left on earth? And quite possibly one star less in heaven.
Oh, no. Humanity is not like that. It can't be. I know it can't. My heart tells me that. So that's what you really, really think. And now I know. You're jealous of your power. The power of the few over the many. You're afraid that I'll end it. Well, Mr. Foreign Secretary, I will end it.
Francis, we are the representatives of the millions. And as men go, no better and no worse than those we represent. What we are is more knowledgeable. Yes, that's it. Through our experience in government, we know more. And one thing we know is that mankind cannot be trusted with this secret.
There's something more important than knowledge. Goodwill. And you haven't got it. But those millions have. Mr. Foreign Secretary, I ask you, what can you know of humanity if you don't love it?
I beg your pardon for smiling, Francis. But how can you, a recluse, a hermit who shuts himself up in a laboratory, how can you, I say, love humanity if you don't know it?
I trust it. And love begins with trust.
Well, government's not here to trust or to hope or believe either. We are here to govern.
Mr. Stapp, you're here to believe, and by the Lord, I'll make you.
What's that? What's that? You'll make us.
Francis, do you believe?
That humanity is not destructive? That with my discovery, the control over atomic force, that people, the little people, will not destroy the earth, but create instead a paradise, a wonder world, a world of beauty and leisure and peace? Yes! I believe it absolutely.
Poor boy. Then you refuse to destroy the secret?
I do.
Francis,
you're my nephew, my own sister's child. I beg
no.
You.
No.
Francis, I have the concurrence of my colleagues in saying that if you will grant our request, we will put every possible facility for research at your disposal. And our facilities are only equaled by our resources.
You're trying to bribe me? Me, the master of the atom? How frightfully funny.
Francis.
Yes, Mr. Foreign Secretary.
I say in all sincerity, do not be so hard. Forgive man for being what he is.
My hardness will make man what he might be.
Have pity.
Where your pity ends, my love begins.
My boy, you don't know what love is. If you did, you'd know right and wrong.
Right and wrong? Your right and wrong are yesterday's. Mine are tomorrow's.
Then you will crucify a man on the cross of your impossible dreams.
I will raise man, though it be upon a cross, though it be with thorns. Goodbye.
Wait, Francis. My boy, I advise you not to leave this room.
Oh. Now this begins to be interesting. First you flatter, then you bribe. Now you threaten.
Francis, we have no desire to proceed to extreme measures. But civilization has the right to protect itself against such enemies as you.
Mr. Foreign Secretary, I realize now that in spite of your intelligence and understanding, or rather because of it, you are by far the wickedest of all.
Wicked? Perhaps. Shall I ring the bell, Prime Minister?
I warn you, Francis. You shall not leave this room in your present state of obstinacy, except under escort of Inspector Forrester of the London Police, who is waiting just outside that door. Well? Ring the bell, Austin.
You lean on that button. Lean on it hard. Ring the bell. Ring every bell in London.
Francis, my boy, we know the game, if nothing else. Believe me, we're old hands at it.
The game. So that's your secret. You all think it's a game. It's your way of evading responsibility. Win like gentlemen, lose like gentlemen, but play the game. Very well, then. If it's a game, let's play it. By Jove, if there's to be a world drama here, I'll play Caesar. When I first took my place among you by right as the greatest benefactor mankind has ever known, the first word that I heard here was war. And since then, all I've heard is distrust and power and destruction. I who bring love and life and hope, you've dragged me down, you've made me fight. Very well, then, I'll meet you on your own atrocious level. Mr. Foreign Secretary, summon your police force.
Can I ring the bell, Prime Minister?
Now, stop! Before you touch that button, listen, all of you. Last week, I came here a boy full of hope. Today, I stand here a man whose despair reaches down into hell. But one learns in this room. Last week, when I left here, my heart knew your wickedness. And I made my preparations.
What preparations?
My preparations. Am I not to be shot at sunrise or buried alive or something? Well, a man has to make preparations for such an important event. Listen, gentlemen, and understand this. Either by noon tomorrow, you will be prepared to formulate under my supervision a constructive program satisfactory to me, or at 1 o'clock tomorrow, England ends. Where this island was will be nothing but a whirlpool of disintegrating atoms. Good day. Furthermore, if anyone lays his hands on me, or if in the meantime I should come to an unexpected or convenient end, no power at present known to man can avert that catastrophe. You see, the accident will guarantee the explosion. Good day, gentlemen.
Quick. Have Inspector Forrester follow him. Search his room. And for God's sake, tell them not to touch him.
Inspector Forrester?
Yes, Egan.
I've searched his night table and dresser.
Hey, what about the suitcase?
Empty. If we only knew what this thing looked like.
We don't. All we know is the control. The thing he controls the apparatus with.
What apparatus?
Now look here, Higgins. This is a very hush-hush matter. Concerns the safety of the Empire, of His Majesty himself.
Blimey.
Nobody knows what it looks like, but we've got to find it. Try the high board.
I'm at it now. Is it big or little?
Can't tell. You could spot something that might be it. Be careful.
What do you mean?
Don't touch it.
Why not?
Touch the control part of it and everything blows up.
Blimey. What do I do? Take a picture of it?
I brought along a pair of tongs. Finish with the high boy.
Nothing but shirts and things.
What about the bed?
All over it. Twice.
Medicine chest? Soap? Tube of toothpaste?
Not a thing.
Then it's not in this room.
Maybe it carries it on him.
Not likely. Can't pass it up, though. You wait in the lobby. After he's come in and gone to sleep, let yourself in. Search his clothes. You'll find it in these tongs. Report to me immediately, one way or the other.
Right, Inspector.
Good. What time is it?
11:31 a.m. Well, Dedham, what about your man Forrester?
Nothing. If he'd found the thing, we'd have heard from him.
Come in. Come in, Francis. You're early.
Am I?
Our answer is brief. We've no alternative. We capitulate.
Do you? No, gentlemen. I am beaten. I capitulate.
What?
You destroy your secret, then? Something the Foreign Secretary said. Right and wrong, and what is right. So who am I? If man has not yet sufficiently evolved to face life, who am I to force him to face it? Have I that right?
No, Francis, you have not.
So, gentlemen, there was a planet called Earth. And after inconceivable millennia, life emerged from that planet's slime. Again, eons passed in unimaginable agonies. And at last, that life, which was now none other but the mind of man, lifted itself high enough to unriddle the profoundest enigma of the universe, the control of atomic force. And then, suddenly, that dream was shattered. And not by nature jealously guarding the secrets, but by the very constitution of man himself. Man, I say, who will not accept responsibility until he's ready for it. And I who gave man this opportunity am about to take it away. And gentlemen, in a brief moment, this planet and all upon it, with all its history, its hopes, and its disillusions, will be wiped out.
That's impossible.
You see that clock? When the two arms of that clock coincide at noon, I will return and stand among you. And with you evaporate into dust, even as all men in this very globe itself will evaporate. I give it 15 minutes more. 15 minutes for you to come to terms with your God.
What time is it now?
12:10.
He can't. I mean, I say, listen. Listen, I say. Good Lord, look at you all. I say, what's the matter with you? You understand what I'm saying? He's going to blow. Oh, but it's absurd. Absurd, but he can. He will.
When you've quite finished babbling, my lord, Dedham, will you kindly leave go of my sleeve? I must think.
Austin, can he do it?
I believe he can.
How?
I don't know.
Strange creature. My nephew is at this moment feeding the pigeons in the park. Have a look through this window.
Oh, what time is it?
Who cares? While there's still a minute, there's all light. He must control that mechanism some way. And our job is to get hold of that control. Has Forrester reported yet?
No, not yet.
It isn't away somewhere in it. It's ticking away. Ticking away our lives.
Ticking away the world, my friend. That's what counts.
Gentlemen, the last time I exert my authority. Silence, please. We have 6 minutes left. If you can pray. Pray for the soul of that deluded boy. And give thanks for the beauty and bravery. Have been on her. Failing that, at least preserve men's dignity by silence.
The minstrel boy to the war has gone.
Shut up, Adam.
In the ranks of death, you'll find him. His father's sword.
Shut up, Adam. Now listen, all of you.
One moment, Cap. Prime Minister, colleagues. I must testify to the truth before I die. The boy is right. Nature, not he, has put humanity on trial. A great opportunity was given us, and we were not great enough to take it. And because we have failed to evolve a faith adequate to this opportunity, nature rejects us for new experiments, perhaps even now on another planet. That is the truth, gentlemen, and I'm glad to have come to it.
To the devil with your truth, faith, and humanity. So, the celebrated foreign secretary is licked, is he? Well, not the secretary of war, not Richard Sapp. Now maybe you'll listen to me. Yesterday, this scientific genius said he'd destroy England at 1 o'clock. Today, he's speeding it up and finishing the world at noon. Consequently, he must have a control.
Of course he has. Who is it?
Forrester, sir.
Oh, come in, Forrester. Any luck?
No, sir. My man searched his clothes last night. Nothing in them but a notebook, his watch, and money. We've spent the morning studying his assistants. They've no idea where the control's kept. I'm sorry, sir.
Thank you. That'll be all, Forrester.
They can't find it. And yet he's never been out of sight. I tell you, the control's on him somewhere, and I'm going to get it.
But do you...
Shut up! Prime Minister, oblige me by moving away from that window.
Step, put down that gun.
I will not. Now then, you all in your hearts want him dead. It's his life or the world's. The choice is simple. Prime Minister, move away from that window.
No, Step. You can't shoot him out there in the open.
Right, son. I'll wait till he comes in. Now give me a clear field of fire. Grindle, you open the door. That's it. Blunt, stand the other side. Right. Now, where's Dedham?
Over there in the corner, still blubbering.
Now, the moment Francis Lightfoot enters this room, I shoot and shoot to kill.
He's coming, the minstrel boy.
Why? One shot right through the heart. Well,
right through the heart.
Good. Lock the door, Grindle. Put him on the table.
2 die by dt squared minus c delta squared.
Gibberish, eh?
No, Mr.
I equal
Clark Maxwell's formulation of the theory of light, pure poetry.
Well, it's all gibberish to me. Grab that out of his hand, quick. What is it?
His watch.
That must be the control. Give it to me.
Carefully, man. Carefully. How does it work?
Wireless, of course. Set for instantaneous explosion.
Oh, good Lord.
All Lightfoot had to do was to press this. Death froze his fingers.
No, my friend. He still breathes.
My secret. You can't. You can't destroy
him. We can. And we will. The world isn't ready for your discovery yet, my boy.
You can't destroy my secret. At this moment, somewhere in the world, men are working in laboratories. You can't hold that knowledge. Can't hold back the world. Nature's secret. They'll find it again. Give it to the people. New world. No. No more fear. Only truth. Only truth. And beauty.
My nephew is dead.
The war has gone. In the ranks of death, you'll find him.
Lawrence Langner again, speaking for the Theatre Guild. Thank you, Burgess Meredith, Henry Daniel, Cecil Humphreys, Everett Sloan, and all of you in the cast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce you to some of our opening night audience. First of all, I want you to meet Miss Teresa Helburn, co-director of the Theatre Guild. I'll try to describe her to you. She's charming, energetic, attractive, beautiful and brilliant, and she's standing right here beside me. And for some reason I've never been able to understand, she has bright blue hair. I've gotten along wonderfully with her all these years in the Guild by following a very simple rule. I always let her have her own way. It saves her the trouble of taking it.
Lawrence, it's certainly nice to know I've had my own way. It didn't always seem so at the time.
Well, it's all in the point of view, Terry. This is a new kind of opening night for us, isn't it?
Yes, but opening nights are all about the same. Half fun, half fright. I've been thinking of one nearly 21 years ago, the opening of Molnar's play, The Guardsman. I'd wanted to have a certain young newly married couple play the lead. Neither of them was a star, and they'd never played together before. But I had a hunch that they were the only ones to act in The Guardsman. The owners of the play didn't agree with me at all. In fact, the only way they'd allow us to produce it with this young couple was to pay an extra royalty as a penalty. The curtain rose that night on the first performance together of Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne. When it descended, history had been made, and so had America's most famous acting team. And now I have a piece of good news for you. Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne are going to do 10 plays on this program during the coming season.
Thank you, Terry. Here in the audience tonight, we have another team which has made theatrical history. Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, creators of the Theatre Guild's musicals, Oklahoma and Carousel. Dick, I remember when the Guild produced your first success, the Gary Gaieties. I suspect you do, too.
I certainly do. I had a wonderful offer at the time to go into a successful business and ultimately become a partner and guess what? Selling babies' underwear. I was broke and on the point of accepting it when I got a telephone call saying the Guild wanted me to write music for the Gary Gaieties. I dropped the baby's underwear like a hot penny, and I've been composing music ever since.
Good.
I don't think you'll ever want to pick up that baby's underwear again, Dick. What about you, Oscar? You were trained to be a lawyer.
Yes, Lawrence. But writing shows and there is in my blood and the law wasn't, I guess. Besides, nobody offered me a partnership in anything. Not even baby's underwear.
Oh, how pathetic. But now you've formed the partnership of Rodgers and Hammerstein, you haven't done so badly. Your song, If I Love You, from Carousel, is quite high on the hit parade, isn't it, Oscar?
I really couldn't say. I haven't checked it since 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Thank you, Oscar and Dick.
Steel Corporation, sponsor of the Theater Guild on the Air, hopes that you'll be with us next week at the same time for our second performance, when we will bring you the Theater Guild's recent comedy success, Yagabowski and the Colonel, starring Annabella, Oscar Walrus, and Louis Calhoun.
The Theater Guild on the Air on Tuned to Yesterday from September 9, 1945 on ABC, that program's first broadcast. And the curtain comes down on this hour of Broadway on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. It's been a pleasure.